discretion is advised.
Hello, everyone. Happy Halloween, and welcome to the United Nations of Horror. I am Alucard Dragomir on Facebook, and real-life people know me as Jason. No, not Jason Voorhees. Haha, I joke. But seriously, happy Halloween. On this episode, we're actually going to revisit a classic episode of UNH, and that is Halloween versus Halloween. This is one of my favorite episodes because we take a look at the original John Carpenter Halloween films, and we also debate the Rob Zombie Halloween films that have been so divisive over the years. And I find that interesting in the term divisive, because with the new Halloween 2, or Halloween 2021, as it will probably become known, that film is definitely divisive at this point. Fans either seem to love it or hate it. Also, before we delve into this classic episode, I want to invite you all to join us on Twitch for our Halloween stream. It's going to be a blast. So, UNH gets twitchy. Yes, folks, it's back on Saturday, October 30th at 10 p.m. British Standard Time, 5 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Central, 2 p.m. Pacific Time. We will be watching Spider Baby and Carry On Screaming. So we're actually going to start, originally the post said about 30 minutes early, but we're actually probably going to start about an hour early. I've got a little documentary and some fun trailers before we get to the films. So please join us. Put the date in your calendar. Create a free account on Twitch. If you don't already have one, you can just go to twitch.tv. And really, I mean, if you have a Gmail or any other email address, that'll work. Sign up is very easy. This is all free, so no charge. And of course, continue to follow our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/UNofHorror. And we will have all the latest updates there, as well as a reminder when the Twitch feed goes live. And so all of us at UNH wish you a very happy, fun, safe Halloween. This is my favorite time of year. I love it. Horror movies, candy, it doesn't get better than that. All right, and now let's revisit this classic episode.
The United Nations of Horror is a podcast about all things horror. Our three hosts hail from different parts of the globe. This gives our listeners a unique perspective. From modern horror classics of yesteryear to the newest releases, from horror novels to historic horror books, if it's about horror, you can be sure that it will indeed be a part of the conversation. Please visit us online at www.unhpodcast.com. We invite you to come interact with us on facebook.com/groups/UNofHorror and on Twitter at twitter.com/UNHpodcast. And now, we welcome you back into our Dungeon of Diabolical Delights. Welcome to the United Nations of Horror.
I'm Lucard Dragomir from Atlanta, Georgia, and I am joined by
Mike Anarino from Chicago, Illinois,
and Rebecca Booth from Oxfordshire in the UK.
This week, the topic is Halloween versus Halloween, and it's one I've wanted to do for a long time. Carpenter's Halloween versus Rob Zombie's Halloween. And we've talked about it a little bit on the show.
Yeah.
And our opinions, but we haven't let loose on what we really think. So you're going to get it uncut here, folks. But before we move into that, just want to give a spoiler warning, because we are going to talk pretty in depth about these films. But if you're shy about spoilers, then you may want to go ahead and turn the podcast off here. There you go. There's your spoiler warning. So shall we get into it, guys?
Sure.
Yep.
So, of course, John Carpenter directed the original. We're going to talk a little bit about the plot first. It takes place in Haddonfield, Illinois on October 31st of 1963. You have a 6-year-old Michael Myers, and he's played by Will Sadden. And he murders his older sister, Judith, who is played by Sandy Johnson. He stabs her with a kitchen knife. And I'm sure at the time this film was released,
it was probably considered just horrible.
They kind of shocking thing.
Yeah, because stuff like that just didn't happen that often back then, right?
Right.
If it did, it was very rare. So we cut to October 30th, 1978, and you have an adult Michael Myers now, and he escapes the Smith's Grove Sanitarium. He's been committed there since the murder. From there, he steals a car, which is something you'll never, ever see in another Halloween movie, I don't think. Because he drives a good bit in this movie. Like,
a lot,
I remember the first time I watched this, you know, I had actually seen other Halloween movies before I saw the first one, and I thought, man, it's so weird to see Michael Myers driving around town. He steals the car, and he heads to his old stomping grounds. At this point, he is 21 years old and played by Nick Castle. He gets the famous blue jumpsuit and the white mask. I've always found it so entertaining that it was a William Shatner mask turned inside out and painted.
Yeah, I think it's a mask from The Devil's Reign, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a scene with Shatner in that. I just saw, just by happenstance, I saw a little clip of it the other day. Where I think it's in the trailer for The Devil's Reign, where you see Shatner, and you look at it, and it's like, oh, that's the Michael Myers mask. Like, that's it. It's really weird.
So then we meet high school student Laurie Strode, who is played by Jamie Lee Curtis. And she's walking with her two friends. And I got to ask, what did you guys think of Laurie Strode and her friends upon first meeting them?
One of the things I really like about this movie is that people say the acting and the dialogue isn't great, but I actually kind of found myself really kind of warming up to these characters, especially Laurie's friends, played by Nancy Loomis and P.J. Souls. Like, P.J. Souls' character, I really like. I found them very likable, and especially P.J. Souls, who's kind of the comedic relief character, I guess, if you wanted to put a role onto each of them, she's the comedic relief. She's the more goofy one. But that character, that type of character, always kind of hits me the wrong way, and they always annoy me. But I never found her annoying. I always found her really entertaining. You kind of feel for these characters in a way, even though they're not super developed. But you relate to them, and you can kind of see everyday people in them, at least from that time. And so I liked them.
I mean, I absolutely love the film. It's if I had to pick one, you know, favorite horror film, I think this would be it. So, again, you know, I can see all of your points there, Mike. But I think the fact that you referred to them as actors, that's what people don't like about them, because they're quite one-dimensional. And they, you know, they don't kind of paint women in the best light, some of the things they're talking about. Which is basically, you know, they're talking about cheerleading, how they look, sex, boys. One of them doesn't, you know, doesn't care that she hasn't brought her books, what's the point of books, and she goes into a massive spiel about it. But I think the Faculty of Horror podcast cover this point really well, which is a podcast run by two women who are academics and journalists. And they compare this film to Black Christmas, which was, I think, 4 years before Halloween it was released. And just the way that the female characters in that film are portrayed, they seem to be very kind of fleshed out in comparison to this. And that's maybe a conversation for another time. But when you compare the two, the characters in this, like I say, are very one-dimensional. But the film kind of is what it is, and I still love it. And I still find them that, you know, you do warm to them. Again, so like Mike was saying, so I don't know, I'm kind of torn in the way they are portrayed when you take into account Black Christmas, but no, I quite like them. I think it was an interesting choice to cast Jamie Lee Curtis, because she's kind of known in her roles after this, playing quite a sexual, confident character. So it's quite interesting to kind of look at this with that knowledge in mind, because she's so kind of meek and mild. But yeah, I think so. She's very much kind of quintessential final girl, if you're aware of Carol J. Clover's term from Men, Women, and Chainsaws.
I haven't heard of that term, actually. Can you kind of inform me and inform our listeners?
Sure. So the final girl, as like I say, coined by Carol J. Clover, basically it's a girl within a slasher horror film that is generally the sole survivor, and she confronts the killer at the end of the film. And she has a specific kind of role, certain traits, and these include being sexually unavailable or virginal, avoiding the vices that cause the other characters to be victims, so sex, illegal drug use, a hedonistic lifestyle. She generally has a unisex name, like Laurie, Sydney, Billy, Georgie, Teddy, and quite often she'll have a shared history with the killer. So, for example, in Scream, the killer is related to Sydney. You know, it's her boyfriend and one of her friends. So that kind of shared history. And basically, Clover said that audience identification is unstable and fluid across gender lines within the slasher film particularly. And the final girl, during her confrontation with the killer, becomes masculinized through what she described as phallic appropriation, in that she takes up a weapon such as a knife, a chainsaw, or in Halloween, a knitting needle, and she then fights the killer. And she talks about the phenomenon of the male audience having to identify with a young female character in what is arguably a male-orientated genre. And that raises interesting questions. But the problem I have with Clover's book, as fantastic as it is that it only really talks about the male audience within the horror genre, and female horror fans are largely ignored in academia and fanzines, any type of writing on the subject, really. And so, it's an interesting trope, it's an interesting consideration. And Halloween was largely credited with setting off this final girl notion, really. Even though Black Christmas came before by a few years, Black Christmas, the women in that, like I say, were much more fleshed out. And the main character in it is actually talking about having an abortion. So she isn't virginal. The girls in that are drinking, they're acting more like you'd expect young women to do. So it's quite interesting between the two in that Black Christmas and Halloween are considered to be, there's a lot of argument over which is the quintessential slasher or which kind of birthed the genre. But if you're talking about the final girl and the trope and how that's kind of developed throughout later films, then I think you have to take that with Halloween, because Black Christmas is a bit of an anomaly, even though Halloween and John Carpenter borrowed a lot from that film.
Wow, this is a book I've got to read at some point, because I've heard about it so much, so often in so many podcasts, and it just sounds like a very interesting read.
It really is. She covers all sorts. I mean, supernatural films, slasher films. It's a cracking read, and I definitely recommend it. It's just my personal kind of take on it that it doesn't consider female horror fans, which is obviously quite important to me personally. But
yeah, certainly.
No, it's a seminal book for anybody who's interested in the slasher films.
My criticism of the film is actually kind of the acting. And I know we're looking back at a film that came out, in the 70s, but I just find the conversations they're having to be, not even the subject matter of the conversations, I just find it to be rather unbelievable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can see what you mean.
As far as Laurie's character, she's definitely sort of the good girl, virginal type. I believe that's definitely kind of what they were going for there. But she does smoke the joint in the car at one point. So
that's,
I guess,
true.
You could say.
That really stood out to me watching this.
Yeah.
You watching it for the podcast. Yeah, definitely. That's thinking about the final girl aspect. Yeah, that makes her stand out. But I think that just gives her a bit more, just fleshes her character out a bit, I think, to make her more believable, really.
More relatable to
yes.
Kind of like high school kids, especially in the suburbs.
Yeah.
Especially around that time period, too, because marijuana back then was just thought to be this horribly evil thing. Laurie is definitely the responsible one of these three girls. She's babysitting, but then the one friend, of course, wants to sneak out and see her boyfriend, and, the other girl is, I believe, already seeing her boyfriend, so she's definitely presented as the only responsible one in this film.
Yeah, she's the more, I guess, mature, the more adult.
Yeah, but I think that's got a lot to do with, again, Halloween being credited as one of the first films to, in terms of the slasher genre, to kind of act as a parable, kind of warning for teenagers about being promiscuous and how that can have, obviously, fatal results. Just, yeah, kind of warning to youngsters, really, about the dangers of promiscuity. And it seems to be that because she's so level-headed and she's the only one that's not kind of distracted by boys and sex, that she survives, basically.
Definitely. We'll go ahead and touch on this. Her other few friends, they do not survive, and they're killed pretty quickly along with their lovers. So if you're the guy, you're not off the hook either. Donald Pleasance plays Dr. Loomis, and I love Dr. Loomis. He is my favorite character throughout all the Halloween movies. And of course, he's in pretty much almost all of them. He is just so good in these films. He brings this almost over-the-top enthusiasm. You could say, perhaps, that it's overacted. But kind of. I don't know. I mean,
it kind of fits the character.
Yeah, I think so, too. Like, he's just so obsessed with keeping, you know, people safe from Michael Myers, and he just believes that Michael Myers is the absolute incarnate of evil. Like, to him, Michael Myers is Satan.
I met him 15 years ago. I was told there was nothing left. No reason, no conscience, no understanding, and even the most rudimentary sense of life or death, of good or evil, right or wrong. I met this 6-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up, because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil.
What do we do?
He's been here once tonight. I think he'll come back.
I think he does a great job of bringing that almost supernatural element of Michael Myers into it, because at first you would think, you know, he's just a killer with a mask, but no, obviously he's more than that. I mean, Michael Myers can go through walls and get stabbed, and yet he still gets back up. And Dr. Loomis is really the only one who understands this evil.
Yeah, completely. I think if you have a drinking game while you're watching this and you have to drink anytime he says evil, Satan, or shouts, I think you're going to get pretty drunk.
Hell, you'll die by the end of the movie.
Yeah, you very well might.
No, he's amazing. I mean, he's one of my favorite things about the series too, and it's just, he really adds to the rewatchability factor of these films. And I mean, he's comedy gold. I mean, I'll watch it again and again and just laugh my head off at some of his lines.
A quote that you have here, Becky, from John Carpenter, he says, "Halloween was a haunted house story and an attempt to do a horror film which incorporates all of the devices that you would expect from a horror film. No need for an extensive plot, just pure evil on the loose on Halloween night. We gave the evil form and a reason to do what it does, and just let it go from there." And I think that really sums up the film very well, because it's simplistic, but it totally works because it's simplistic.
I think not only the plot, but also the soundtrack, everything about it. I mean, that's, you know, really simple, but really iconic as well.
No doubt. John Carpenter, I mean, he composed that himself. I can't remember if it was an extra now or something on AMC I saw, but it was showing Halloween, like, without Carpenter's music, and how it basically wasn't very frightening, but then you add in Carpenter's music, and it becomes much more eerie and frightening.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, I think he showed it to, a studio executive without any sound, and they were just kind of nonplussed watching it. And then when he added the music and, like you say, you know, had screenings, apparently, yeah, everybody was terrified. But, I mean, it's a great score. It's fantastic.
I didn't even know Haddonfield was, like, an actual place. That's cool. One of the things that I like about this movie is that it's instantly relatable because, like, I lived out here in the Chicago suburbs. And so walking out in the October day, I mean, that's exactly what you see in Halloween. The scenes I see out there in the day, I can walk outside and see that almost every day. And that to me, it's just something that brings it that much closer to reality and that much, it hits so much closer to home that way. And I've always just found that really interesting. Like whenever I marathon these movies and I walk outside and it's October, I mean, it just adds a different kind of dimension to that. That's really cool.
Nothing like that over here.
Yeah.
Now, the writers were also playful in naming their characters. Psychiatrist Sam Loomis was named after John Gavin's character in Hitchcock's Psycho, which, for whatever reason, I did not know until you showed me these notes, Becky. I did not make the connection, believe it or not.
I'm a huge Hitchcock fan, so that was always something that kind of endeared me to these films as well.
Yeah, Hitchcock is amazing.
Yep, and like I say, huge Dr. Loomis fan. We had, when I was at university, we named the flat the Dangertainment flat after the last, I think, film in the original franchise, which was Halloween Resurrection. And
oh, yeah.
Which, again, people hate it, but I love this franchise. Absolutely adore it. So yeah, we were known as the Dangertainment flat, and we had a picture of Donald Pleasance on the fridge.
Oh, that's cool.
That is cool.
Pride of place.
Sheriff Leigh Brackett was named after science fiction author and screenwriter Leigh Brackett, who wrote the screenplay for The Big Sleep in 1940, The Long Goodbye in 1973, and this was really interesting to me, The Empire Strikes Back in 1980.
Right.
And Michael Myers was named after the head of the now-defunct English distribution company Miracle Films, which had released Carpenter's Precinct 13 in the UK in 1978. We also talked a bit about the mask earlier. The mask was a costume store William Shatner-like faceplate turned inside out and painted white. So let's talk about some of the film's argued influences, particularly by the following films, and I want to know if you guys agree with this. George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
Definitely when Loomis drives up to the sanatorium and finds that all of the inmates have escaped and they're walking around in their kind of white sheets that they're draped in, like nightgowns. And that really was, me, really reminded me of Night of the Living Dead. That bit was really quite scary as well. And then obviously Michael jumps onto the top of the car. I find that bit really creepy.
Mm-hmm. I did too, even now.
Yeah.
With the nurse and everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine being trapped in a car with this psychotic killer right on the outside?
Yeah.
and then on the top of your car, for goodness sakes. I mean, oh my God. The next one, Mario Bava's Bay of Blood, 1971.
No, I've never seen
it. I've not seen this.
Bay of Blood, yes. I mean, I think because of kind of gore, I would say, more than anything. I don't think the story particularly, but just as an influence in terms of the murders and the gore within the film, which, as you say, I think Halloween would have been quite shocking at the time, particularly because in the opening scenes, I mean, it's a six-year-old child that's committing the murders. So I think that more than anything would have been quite shocking to audiences.
Also, The Exorcist from 1973, as far as the lighting goes, I definitely see that in Halloween.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't stand out to me as a huge kind of like when I watch Halloween, all like I can think about certain things that remind me of The Exorcist. But when you say lighting, I guess I could see that, yeah. It has that kind of look to it.
I think as well, the plot is quite subtle and it moves along quite slowly. And I think that's the same thing with The Exorcist. I know it's a supernatural slow burn, and you could argue that Halloween is a little bit supernatural, but just the fact that the story is very simple and goes along at a very steady pace. That's how I would kind of link the two.
Yeah, I can definitely see that as well. And man, I gotta say, The Exorcist still just scares the living hell out of me to this day. We already discussed this one, Bob Clark's Black Christmas from 1974.
Well, yeah, because I think what Becky mentioned earlier with kind of Halloween giving birth to the idea of the final girl, I had never thought of that before, and I actually really agree with that. But besides that, I think Black Christmas and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre both came out in 74, and I think they really are the granddaddies of the slasher genre. I think those really are the most influenced movies as far as the slashers that that follow. I think they really set up a lot of archetypes and certain just story aspects that really paved the way for all slasher to come.
No, I completely agree. And even though this seems to be a constant argument about whether Black Christmas or Halloween kind of birthed the genre, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre seems to be kind of overlooked. And I completely agree with you. That is, you know, it has a lot of those tropes in there, you know, the slasher film, Final Girl, whatever. But it never seems to be kind of bundled together with Halloween or Black Christmas. And I always found that quite strange.
I find it very strange because there's a lot of similarities between the three films.
Yeah, I think Black Christmas and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, those are, as I said, those are kind of the granddaddies of the slasher. I would say they gave birth to the slasher, but Halloween certainly kicked off the slasher trend, I would say. It brought it really way more into kind of the public eye, and that's because of Halloween. I'd say that's why the slasher genre became so huge in the 80s, and that's why you got, I mean, in like 1981 alone, there were just so many slasher movies that all following on the heels of Halloween.
Halloween certainly made the slasher film cool in that time period, and there were a lot of clones after that, certainly throughout the 80s, and even into the 90s, and then, you know, Scream, of course, took over kind of poking fun at them, but yet it was still a slasher.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't kind of associate Black Christmas or the Texas Chainsaw Massacre with an iconic score like I do Halloween. I think that was a big part of it.
Yeah,
that's true.
The fact that it was made on such a small budget and it was so successful. And also, I'm not aware, but I could be completely wrong, of any films that played on the holiday of, you know, the Halloween holiday before that. So I think that also, because it was released just before Halloween, I think originally in August, that really helped it along in terms of its reception.
I agree, because Halloween was such a big commercial holiday. I mean, really, like going back to the 20s in America, and it kind of cashed in on the holiday, really. And you mentioned the budget. I mean, just $325,000. That's insane. And of the small budget, $25,000 of it was set aside to secure lead actor. And this is something else that I didn't realize. They wanted Christopher Lee to play Dr. Loomis. He was approached, but he said that the character was too one-dimensional, simply mad and dangerous, and Lee couldn't do anything with that, quote unquote. And so then Donald Pleasance was approached, and he agreed to do the project.
And I'm so glad he did.
I am too. I mean, I love Christopher Lee. I'm a massive Christopher Lee fan, but Donald Pleasance, he made the role his own. I don't think it would have worked as good with anybody else.
I think it would have been a very different film with Christopher Lee.
Yeah, it really would have. It would have been a much different performance, I think.
You certainly wouldn't have had those over-the-top moments like with Christopher Lee. You know, Christopher Lee, I believe, he's just too too structured to,
yeah,
you know, to really let loose like that. You've been like Michael Myers. He's evil.
Yeah.
We must dispose of him.
Carpenter was really meticulous in organizing the work schedules so that the actors would be able to film their scenes over shorter periods instead of being on set for weeks at a time to account for the smaller budget.
And that's just another thing, you know, a sign of a master filmmaker. He also storyboarded everything ahead of time, and, you know, he knew exactly what he wanted to make. And, of course, also, you mentioned, Becky, the music. It's just, it's iconic now. You hear that and you immediately think Halloween.
Completely. And I think it's just insane that Carpenter can write, read, or arrange music, because even though it is so simple, it's like Jaws, you know, the theme from Jaws. It's just like you say, as soon as you hear it, boom, you're there.
And I mean, Carpenter really made his name on this. He sold the movie to NBC.
For $4 million.
$4 million, that's not chump change. If I had $4 million, I could live on it for the rest of my life.
Right.
Especially in 1980.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. In October 1980, the film had a second re-release. NBC paid $4 million for the broadcast rights, as you said, and then discovered that the film was too short to fill the two-hour time slot, and this is after it was cut for television. So to compensate, Carpenter and Hill wrote and shot extra scenes originally omitted from the initial filming script, and they did this in 3 days.
Yeah, I remember some extra stuff with Loomis. Because I want to say, on the Scream Factory version I have, I want to say the version I watched was the TV cut. I believe that's if I'm not mistaken.
I think they added the scene in which he references Michael driving the car as well, which is one of my favorite bits, where somebody says, you know, how did he get where he can't even drive? And Loomis says he was doing very well last night, which was crazy.
Oh, right.
Oh, yes.
To explain that, and I saw something on Facebook, obviously around Halloween, talking about, you know, the age-old question, like who taught Michael how to drive, and Adam Green, the filmmaker, he releases a Halloween short every year for free through Aeroscope Pictures, his production company, and one of them is actually a short film in which basically Michael is taking driving lessons. And I would urge anybody to watch that because it's hilarious.
That was funny. I've seen that. That was really funny.
I got to check that out. That sounds epic.
Yeah, with Joel David Moore as the driving instructor.
Yeah.
That stuff's really funny.
It's also interesting to me that, well, the film was novelized by Curtis Richards. And that, I mean, have either of you read this?
No, but I'd like to.
Yeah, exactly. I did not know that the film had been novelized. And especially because it's got such a kind of expanded storyline. It sounds really interesting. The expanded storyline relates quite a bit to the zombie version. I think his film picks up on quite a few of the themes.
Oh, suddenly yeah, I don't want to read it anymore. Like it.
Oh, come on now. We're not even to the zombie version yet.
Now hold on.
Well, I guess we should go ahead and give our thoughts on the original film. We're not going to score it yet, though. We're going to save that for the end. But I know, Becky, you said it's one of your favorite films. Mike, it's obviously a huge film for you as well.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, I certainly enjoy it. So just your overall thoughts on the first Halloween.
There's just something timelessly eerie about it. There's something timelessly freaky about this young suburban boy who just kind of snaps one night with the image of the young Michael having the mask taken off, just being really weird. He doesn't even look like he realizes what he's done. It's so creepy, and that really just sets the bar for just the weird eeriness, and that kind of takes place throughout the rest of the film, that kind of goes up to a climax to where shit kind of starts to hit the fan. It just gets really intense, and you really feel like there's a lot at stake. And so there's something just really timelessly creepy and unnerving about it. So yeah, I absolutely love it.
I just completely agree with everything you said. Just to add that I think it's such a clever, simple, scary film that really holds up to this day, and it just kind of plays on that primal archetypal fear of evil and the unknown at the end of the film, when you have all of the shots of all of the places where Michael has been, and the music's playing and you can hear him breathing, that he could be anywhere. I just think that really stays with you.
Tonight's brutal murders was described by police as Manson-like in its viciousness. Three people brutally murdered and a 10-year-old boy being held in custody.
Said a word for 15 years.
This summer, Rob Zombie unleashes a unique vision of a legendary tale.
Listen, be careful tonight, son. A lot of nutcases come out on Halloween.
Boogeyman real? Why are you so obsessed with the boogeyman, Tommy? Halloween night, the boogeyman attacks kids you don't believe.
Oh no, Tommy! Boogeyman's gonna get me! I'm gonna cut that mask right off your face.
He's come back for his baby sister. To do what?
Let's move on to the Rob Zombie film, and I gotta ask you guys right off the bat, when you first heard Rob Zombie was making a Halloween film, what did you think?
It sounds like kind of a, on paper, it sounds like a good idea, kind of. Especially after, what the, he did this after The Devil's Rejects, right? Wasn't that 05 or something?
I believe so, which, you know, The Devil's Rejects, I really, really like that film.
It's really good.
And I don't know, what did you guys think of... Also, House of a Thousand Corpses, he had done that, obviously.
Yeah, that one's okay. Me, personally, I'm not a big fan of it.
Yeah, I was introduced to Rob Zombie via The Devil's Rejects, which was actually my first 18-certificate film in the UK that I saw at the cinema.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I don't think I was 18 at the time, so I managed to get in, which was great. But I thought it was... I definitely enjoyed it. I thought it was really graphic, and it just really stood out from the other horrors that I'd been watching at that time, because, like I said, I was in my late teens. So it was kind of, you know, a really interesting introduction to him, and I, again, preferred that to House of a Thousand Corpses. But, I don't know, we'll talk about it, I'm sure, but his casting of his wife and all that, I'm sure we'll get into that. But, yeah, the first film, when I first, like I say, watched... The Devil's Rejects, it was, I really enjoyed it. I thought he was good.
Yeah, I saw House of a Thousand Corpses. I wasn't very impressed with that one, but I really liked The Devil's Rejects. In fact, I just rewatched it on Netflix recently and enjoyed it all over again, and I was like, man, this film is still great. It's actually kind of got a horror western vibe going to it. It's so unique.
That's a good word for it, and I can see why he was approached about Halloween on the back of that.
It's on October 31st, 1978. And you've got kid Michael Myers, but it definitely goes into Michael Myers as a child for quite a long time, for the first half of the film. Obviously, young Michael Myers has some issues. He has been murdering animals and taking pictures of them. I mean, this is where it departs from the first film pretty quickly. I mean, also, his family life is just awful. He wears a clown mask basically to escape all this family drama. Like, I've got written down here, like, disturbing white trash family. And then the line that I just, like, even now, it gets me like, oh my god, like, where the stepfather is like,
"Bitch, I will crawl over there and I will skull fuck the shit out of you."
And I put classy father figure. Like my god, I have never heard anything so offensive in my life. Also, his mom is a stripper, and two of the kids are making fun of him for that. So he decides to take matters into his own hands, and at least with the one bully, he just brutally kills him. And I thought that scene was really impactful and actually really well done. I feel like anyone who has ever dealt with a bully will kind of appreciate this scene and just sort of just the power it has.
I'd completely agree. And I think that scene also, I found quite interesting watching watching the Rob Zombie film straight after watching the original Carpenter's Halloween. It was where he was attacking the bully and he had his mask on. And the bully had previously been taunting him about his mother and the fact that she's a stripper, and he had an ad from the paper that had a picture of her wherever she worked. She was on this advertisement, and Michael lifts up his mask to take the piece of paper, the advertisement, off the boy, and then puts his mask back on to just absolutely brutally murder him. And that was really interesting to me, because you got that glimpse of humanity and the mask just completely hid that. And you didn't really have that with the original film. You had no backstory. So I thought that was interesting, and I quite like that in the zombie version.
I did as well. I found all the childhood stuff to be pretty interesting. Now, going back to when the bullies first insult him in the bathroom, like, I don't know about you guys, but I was amazed at, like, the language the kids used. Because, I mean, Rob Zombie, he talks about how kids his age would talk like that in school. And when I was in elementary school, no kids talked like that. I mean, in middle school and high school, yeah. But I'm curious to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, that's the thing, man. Like, the dialogue, especially in that first, well, I mean, I could say throughout the entirety of the movie, is so over the top. I timed it this time. It's 3 minutes and 24 seconds into this movie where I already start to get annoyed and pissed off. Like, Rob Zombie, he's attempting to make Michael Myers a more realistic kind of character, going for a gritty, grounded approach. But he writes and directs these characters in such a cartoonish and straight-up terrible way that it totally just collapses in on itself and becomes far more goofy than any of the other Halloween films, I think. I mean, from the bullies to the line you mentioned with the "I'll skull fuck you, bitch," like that whole the whole family dynamic, the whole, I mean, this will come up later, but there's a rape scene that's really just terrible. It's all just so over the top in how it's done. It's just so dark, and he's trying to make it so evil, but it just ends up being so goofy and just so cartoonish. It's almost a straight-up comedy. It totally becomes the reverse of everything he's trying to do, at least in my opinion.
I can't see it as cartoony. I can see it as over the top. I would certainly say that it is intending to be incredibly offensive, obviously. And I think that's just how Rob Zombie works. I mean, I don't think he's ever going to direct the Santa Claus. You know what I mean?
Right. But, like, making Myers a troubled child, just another kind of troubled kid, to me, that takes away what was so unique about him as a slasher to begin with. Now he's just kind of another twisted kid who grows up to go crazy. I think what was really scary about that first film, and I mean, obviously when you remake a movie, you don't want to do the exact same thing. I do appreciate right. The zombie was trying to do his own thing, but I feel like having that innocent kid who, like, as I said earlier, he doesn't even look like he knows what he did in the original movie. Like, kind of just have him snap like that. I think that's scary. And, like, to me, personally, I think what would be kind of more interesting if you wanted to do the background of Michael Myers would be to kind of take that kid, to take that that young, innocent kid we saw, and as the movie was going on in modern day, we kind of went to flashbacks, or did it a whole first half, whichever way worked, of just this young, just normal suburban kid, as we saw in the original film, and he starts to kind of like hear voices or see like the man in black from the other films. To me, that just seems like a much more interesting kind of movie. And this whole thing where he's just this young kid in this redneck family, he kills animals, he's got this like slutty sister, the mom's a stripper, he got this annoying baby, the dad's a crippled asshole. I mean, it's all just... It isn't, I didn't find it relatable, which is what kind of was so unique about the first movie. And yeah. It just, I can't get into any of the characters. I find them all annoying and just dumb.
Well, I think they were trying, I mean, they didn't really want it to be relatable because they're trying to, in essence, show you that Michael Myers was a serial killer even at a young age. And, I mean, it is true that serial killers, people who are going to grow up to be serial killers, when they're children, they will typically brutalize smaller animals, which, I mean, it's sick, it's disturbing, but it's true. So I think they were going for that, showing him doing this stuff, and I think, you know, they were trying to show he had a really messed up family life, but at the same time, a lot of serial killers come from perfectly normal families, so that's, you know, that's not accurate.
Yeah, I was, reading up on the film and how Zombie wanted to delve into psychopathy and look at potential influences, but also just how people who are psychopathic can just kind of develop, really, from a young age. So it kind of, there's a tension there that he doesn't really need that white trash, horrible background. If you're just looking at how, like with the first film, this character has snapped because, you know, psychopathy is what I've read on the subject. It's inherent within the individual already. And obviously, nurture can exacerbate, but I think that that has to be there already. So that was quite uneven, unbalanced. You know, it kind of stood out quite a bit. And, you know, I also thought that the characters were they were like caricatures over the top also, but I didn't find it to be gritty. Not really goofy. I mean, I can understand how some of it, you know, the lines sound quite comical, but it just pulled me out of the film more than anything. And on top of that, even though I didn't like that and the, you know, the backstory necessarily, I did find that kind of opening dramatic kind of little segment really compelling this time round, watching it and how Loomis comes into their lives and everything. And the one bit I actually did like was a kind of documented regression of Michael when he's in Smith's Grove Sanitarium, when he's making the masks and kind of hiding behind them as he's realizing what he's done, because he's asking questions like, is everybody at home okay? So it's as if he doesn't, kind of like he's got, you know, split personality, I don't know. But I thought that was really interesting, how he was kind of regressing, he's pulling away. You see all these shots of him in black and white, wearing different masks that he's made himself. And Loomis, in a kind of, not a voiceover, but he is speaking and he says, over the shots, and he says that he kind of is falling in on himself and he's becoming a shape of a human being, or something that refers to the shape, obviously, which in the original Halloween, that's what the character was called, the shape. And I thought that was a really interesting kind of tie-in, and I quite liked that, how they were talking about him losing his humanity bit by bit.
I liked that as well. I thought it was really well done.
Another problem I had with it was kind of that I didn't like the background on the whole mask. I think Michael's obsession with masks is where it's too much background on something that didn't need it. I felt it was really unnecessary and didn't add anything to the character. I thought you would do something like that and to flesh something out, an aspect out like that, it should give that character more dimension. And it, to me, it just felt like not quite fan service, but just because, you know, the mask is iconic, we have to do a whole backstory on the mask. And none of it felt natural to me at all.
I really see. I thought they were just trying to add to the story of the mask. You know, and I actually thought that was kind of cool that, you know, skipping ahead, that he buries it under his house, obviously, before the police get there and catch him. And then he comes back, you know, all these years later. And, of course, he's made all these masks to hide his face, but he still wants the original mask where he killed his sister, the boyfriend, and the stepfather.
Is that why because actually I have written down right here, why was the mask under the floorboards at the Myers home? Because I never understood that.
Well, I assume that he just planted it under the house before he went outside with the baby. I just sort of filled that in. I guess one could say it's a plot hole.
I mean, that explanation, I guess that could make sense, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of took it that he kind of had a bit of, I don't know, that was, had something to do with his identity, his murderous, you know, that he left it there, and I don't know, I'd say plot hole too. But I must say, yeah, that the new mask, the upgraded version, I thought was really, I did like the new mask in the new film.
Yeah, it's a good update, I think.
Yeah.
I thought it looked cool, and also I just liked how, when Michael Myers did become an adult, how big they made him. I mean, he looked like a monster.
Yeah.
Do you guys think that a lot of the reason perhaps people don't like this version of Halloween is because they humanized Michael Myers so much at the beginning and sort of almost took away that mystery about him?
Well, that's the thing. I think that you spend, and first off, I don't think I mentioned this, I had the Shout Factory version that only came with the 2-hour version, so I don't know which first of all is painful and you should never watch it, but I don't know how much of it is the same with you guys, but for me it was, I think, 40-45 minutes of it was that background stuff. And to me, that background stuff, first off, I as I said before, I found it kind of too over the top and stuff. But you get to the second half, to where it's all modern day and stuff, I didn't they felt completely separate. That they had attempted to flesh out that Michael Myers character so much that while in the second half he moves around and looks like the younger Myers, but I didn't get a sense of that character anymore. He just kind of became Michael Myers again. He was just another Myers killing people. There wasn't, in an attempt to make something, to make a different kind of Michael Myers, I didn't really think they did.
No, I would agree with that. And I think the two kind of sections, there is a real jolt and it does kind of bring you out a little bit of the film.
I would agree that there is certainly a disconnect there. It's almost a bit like two separate films in a way. Well, the story shifts to Laurie Strode, who is played by Scout Taylor Compton, and her friend, again, Annie Brackett, who this time is played by Daniel Harris, and Linda, who is played by Christina Glebe. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. I mean, this is certainly an updated version. I think they, right from the get-go with Laurie's joke with the bagels, talking about the hardware store guy has, you know, touched her inappropriately. She's joking, of course, but joking with her mother. But obviously, this shows that this is a less, I guess, prudish, maybe, Laurie Strode.
Yes, it's certainly a more modernized Laurie Strode. But to me, their version of modernized was taking, like, the type of people I hated in high school and making them the heroines of this movie. So
for her friends, yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah. Now, I feel like it's weird. They, after that initial joke, they make Laurie much more likable. But, like, the weird, perverted joke, that was a little weird to me. I'm curious what you thought, Becky, from, you know, a female point of view on this.
Well, kind of, when you think about the same characters in Carpenter's version and how they are often described as one-dimensional and people don't like them because of that, I, like Mike said, they're much more endearing than these girls. I mean, even Laurie, when she's babysitting, I mean, she's telling the child that the boogeyman's coming to get him. Her friend comes around to drop the child that she's babysitting off so she can go and have sex with her boyfriend, and in front of the kids they're swearing, they're rubbing up against each other like pretending, like, you know, making kind of sexual like innuendos, and it's just, they're acting like so immature. I don't know, I just felt like, you say, a very cartoonish version of that person you hated in high school, and I just couldn't relate to any one of them at all.
Yeah, they're just kind of annoying. And something I mentioned earlier with BJ Souls, her character earlier, I had mentioned I liked her character because characters like her I usually find annoying, and this is a perfect example. Her character in this movie is exactly what I hate about those kind of goofy comedic relief characters. I mean, they're all kind of on that level in this, but her character in particular I just found really, really annoying.
No doubt about that. And I feel like they tried to humanize the one that was a cheerleader by saying, you know, I care what you think, Lori. You know, I don't care what Annie thinks, but I care what you think.
Right.
And but by then, I feel like it didn't work. Like, they had been so obnoxious that it was just impossible for me to like them at that point. So, thus, when Michael Myers begins viciously murdering them all, I didn't particularly care, to be honest with you. In fact, I was kind of like, yes, thank you, Michael Myers, which is probably not the reaction you want with your characters.
No, and particularly with the strange scene in the sanatorium where the girl is pulled into his room and is raped by the orderlies, which is quite a difficult scene to watch anyway. But
yes,
the fact that he's
very disturbing.
Yeah, definitely. And which Rob Zombie does very well, I think. And I think the fact that he, you know, as an adult, the first killings that you see, you're actually cheering him on there. Well, I was anyway.
Yeah, I was too.
So
yeah.
I wanted these rednecks at the sanitarium to die, like, for what they had done to the poor girl.
Exactly. So I thought that was a really strange way to kind of introduce him as an adult. Because then you're already kind of aligned with him, and that sense for me of that eeriness, that, you know, that dread that was associated with the first character has just completely kind of dissipated.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. I found all the sanitarium stuff as an adult really kind of weird. Like, as you said, I think the whole rape scene is really just kind of terrible and over the top and unnecessary, is which are words I've been using a lot. But
yeah, I did find that scene very unnecessary. Like,
yeah, it's so
what the
weird.
Hell?
And then and it's just, yeah, you got the whole Danny Trejo character, which is, of course, he's just there, so he's gonna be all grinning and super nice so that when Michael Myers kills him, oh, it shows that he doesn't care about anybody. But that's, again, that's done yeah. so over the top. Danny Trejo is so nice. He does everything but have fairy wings and a magic wand. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know if he was the right person to play the sympathetic friend who Michael Myers is gonna murder. Like, even in my notes here, I put, Myers gets out and kills everyone in the mental hospital, including his friend Machete.
Right.
Because I think of Danny Trejo as Machete.
That would have been awesome, like, versus, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just like, it doesn't quite work. But, I mean, I think that was Zombie's way of trying to say, yeah, he doesn't care about anyone. But, yeah, it doesn't quite work. I did particularly like the just brutal fight scene at the truck stop.
Yeah, that one's
brutal
painful.
Brutal fight. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. And, I don't know how they did it, but it looked pretty rough. Scout Taylor Compton versus Jamie Lee Curtis.
That's not even fair. Come on.
I know I'm probably the only one here, but like later on, I actually feel like Scout Taylor Compton does a really good job as far as getting involved in all these horrible things that Myers is doing. You know, I really bought in to the fact that she was scared of Michael Myers. And Jamie Lee Curtis, I mean, she's very likable in the beginning of Halloween, but her voice is so, like, shrill to me and over the top. Like, I don't know, I just never bought she was really that scared in the original Halloween. And I'm guessing I'm alone here. But
like, I could see what you mean by that.
I don't know, it's kind of the opposite for me. I mean, in the zombie version, I think Laurie, she seemed a lot younger. So that kind of factored into it for me a little bit. I think that Jamie Lee Curtis, I found her to be more believable in, you know, she's, I know when the film came out originally, the reception was that, you know, at the end she just wasn't, people were very infuriated by the fact that she didn't kind of fight back enough, but I think that's quite realistic. And I don't know, I just don't feel like the character in Zombies Halloween was as, she seemed very, it was very shallow. I don't know. I thought at the end when she was covered in blood and, you know, those last few scenes, I thought she definitely kind of upped the game a little, but I just couldn't get, I don't know, I just couldn't associate with her before that. All the scenes kind of preceding that, I just couldn't really relate to her at all.
I don't think she's given, I mean, as a performance, she's not terrible. I think she's just not given a lot to do. I don't think she was directed or written particularly well. I mean, when we move on to Halloween 2, that's when I would say she's terrible. But in this, I mean, she does.
Really.
Yeah, she does what she can with what she has, I'd say.
Yeah.
And that's fair.
A quote from Rob Zombie, he says, "If you're going to do the same exact movie with different actors, why bother? What I wanted to do was make it a totally different experience. So within the first 5 minutes of the movie, you're going to go, there's no sense sitting here comparing. It's different. There's nothing to compare," which I wouldn't say there's nothing to compare, but
right.
Because, I mean, obviously he takes some elements from the first Halloween film.
I mean, yeah, there's bits and pieces of music taken straight out of the movie,
yes.
the original movie, that just feels so weird because of that whole notion of he's trying to, and I really appreciate that mindset. I really agree with him on that, which is weird because, like, had I been with him there on production, it feels like we would have agreed with anything, everything. And, like, I see this movie and it's like, what happened? Jesus. It's like, 'cause I agree with so much he's saying, but it just does not translate, at least to me, to screen well. It's such a weird kind of vision. It's not even in, part of it is in comparison, because I mean, it's hard not to compare it, but to me it's just, I don't think, you still have to make a good movie at the end of the day. It doesn't just have to be different, and I personally just don't think it's particularly well done.
I just found that quote to be very interesting because you have to compare, you know, it's a remake. He's taken the music, like you say, directly from the film, which has, you know, straight away, you're instantly going to compare it to the original. So I think it's, you can't really sit there and say, oh, there's no use to, you know, no use comparing. It's completely different. I don't think that's fair at all. And I think he was kind of setting himself up to fail by saying that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I would too. I mean, he definitely pays homage to the original in his way, I suppose. But I don't know if it's the best way. The film did well. I mean, thanks to its opening weekend, $30.5 million, the film broke the box office record for the Labor Day weekend, surpassing the record set in 2005 by Transporter 2, which ironically I saw both these films in theaters. I guess I just like to go to the movies on Labor Day weekend.
And see shitty movies on Labor Day weekend.
Well, you know. It still currently resides as the top Labor Day weekend grosser. The film was released on DVD in the United States. Both the theatrical 109-minute and the unrated director's cut, which is 121 minutes, were released as a two-disc special edition containing identical bonus features. Now, did you guys see the version in the theater? Because it was actually quite different from the uncut edition.
Yeah, when it first came out, I do remember seeing that. I think I was like at 12 at the time, and I had snuck into the theater and seen it. I think that was actually my first interaction with a Halloween movie. And yeah, I remember not being a fan of it, but like I was 12, so all the violence and over-the-topness I was into. So I have fonder memories of it, but yeah, watching it again, it felt very different because I had watched the 2-hour version. If I remember correctly, I think it had a different ending, right?
It did, yeah. Which in the uncut version, Laurie Strode shoots Michael Myers, and then in the original ending, I believe it's he lets Laurie go to Dr. Loomis, but then he takes a step forward, and the cops just open fire. Like,
that's right.
I think it's Halloween 2, which is similar. It may be, it may not be, but one of the Halloween films is very similar. The uncut version and the theatrical version are so different. Like, I remember Dr. Loomis being like just a complete and utter dick in the theatrical version, and then in the uncut version they cut a lot of that crap out, like the book signing and things like that, and they make
him
a little bit more like the old Dr. Loomis. I don't know why that stood out for me so much, but I remember even thinking when I watched the theatrical version, you know, all those years ago, like, man, they killed Dr. Loomis's character for me, you know?
Which they do in, that's kind of, they brought that back in Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, where they kind of made him an asshole.
Let's pretend that doesn't exist.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that we can agree on. Let's not do that.
Upon the release of the film, Zombie said, "I definitely would not do sequels. I want to make one great movie." Zombie's Halloween 2 was released in 2009. And Halloween 2, oh my god.
Word abomination,
I mean, I shouldn't throw it around lightly, but it's awful. And I did not watch it again in preparation for this podcast, but I saw it once, guys, and that was enough. I'll probably never watch it again.
Yeah, just recently, because I think it was last year I did a whole Halloween marathon, the whole series. And when I got the box set, I did it again. And I got about to like the 45-minute mark in Halloween, in Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, and I was like, well, why am I doing this? And I just shut it off. I was like, I don't think I ever have to watch that movie again. I think once was enough. Once and a half was perfectly enough.
I mean, there are a few scenes in that movie that I enjoyed, but the overall package of that movie is not very good in my
opinion.
What
was he thinking with that? That movie is so weird in just how bad it is.
Yeah, it goes off its rails and almost reminds me of a Japanese horror film. Like, a Japanese horror film is not very good, let me put it that way.
Yeah.
But as far as Halloween, the Rob Zombie remake goes, I guess we've come to a point where we should discuss our overall thoughts about the film and then give some ratings.
Actually, I just wanted to throw in one more thing.
Yeah,
and it has to do with the violence in the movie. Another thing that Zombie seems to find scary is having people just bleed all over the place and shake and scream and cry for 5 minutes. And like, I mean, I guess he was trying to do, he was trying to make it more, I guess, real, the violence. But for me, the way he does it, I didn't find it scary. I found it boring and kind of over the top and dumb. That's another thing to where he's trying to get something through to you, and it totally just didn't to me. It's a concept that I would find scary, that kind of real kind of getting. He tries to show that, hey, getting killed with a knife, that's a slow and painful death. But I didn't find it worked here at all. I didn't find that scary the way he portrayed it.
I thought the murders in the second film, Zombies Halloween 2, I actually found to be more effective. Some of the kills in that, I didn't find them to be as over the top. Especially the killing of the nurse. I just thought that was really brutal. And that one particular scene really, really stood out from the rest of the film, which maybe because the rest of the film was just bizarre. But yeah. I don't know that second one, because of the way that the first film was kind of chopped up a bit, I don't know whether the same thing happened with the sequel, and I don't know, and things just went all over the place. I don't know, in terms of editing, whether that's got anything to do with the way that it unfolds in that strange kind of dreamlike way, but I don't know. I definitely know what you mean, though, about in the first film, in terms of the violence and how straight away it's kind of in your face.
Yeah, it's very kind of over the top and brutal, which I appreciate all the kind of over the top violence, but it does feel a bit out of place in this film.
Just to ask you both about, in the first film, in the scene where Laurie is in high school and her English teacher is lecturing the class, she's actually talking about fate in one of Samuel's novels, and she just kind of drones on, and there's this kind of monologue from her, and at the same time, Laurie's looking out the window and she sees Michael stood by the car, and then she's actually directly addressed by the teacher and is asked a specific question about fate in these novels, and then the teacher's voice can be heard again as she's looking out the window to see that Michael's gone, and it's basically the teacher's lecture carries on to say, in Samuel's writing, fate is immovable like a mountain. It stands where man passes away. Fate never changes. And I just wanted to know kind of what you two thought of that, because fate seems to come into the sequel, as in Carpenter's Halloween 2, and I'm not sure if he wrote that, if he had that in mind when he first wrote the first film, but the way that Laurie turns out to be Michael's sister in that, and that's obviously developed throughout the franchise with Jamie Lee Curtis coming back for Halloween H2O and Halloween Resurrection to play Michael's sister, and how that kind of steers the narrative in those films. But how you thought, really, fate, you know, that seemed to me quite a lot of discussion on the subject in that scene, considering that the first film doesn't really go into that. I just thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really think too much about that scene until you brought that up, but talk about some foreshadowing. I don't know if he, I mean, certainly he couldn't have known that there was going to be so many sequels, obviously, but I mean, maybe it's one of those things that that just worked out. I think maybe at the time he was foreshadowing the fact that Michael Myers was coming to the town, you know, maybe that's why he wrote it that way.
And that they were brother and sister. I think that kind of ties into that, too.
Do you think he had it in his head back then, though?
I mean, well, does the brother and sister thing, is that brought up in the, or is that the second one?
That's the second film. And I always found it quite interesting that the second film picks up exactly where the first film finished. And I'm not sure of any other films that do that, apart from, like Lord of the Rings.
I think the whole brother and sister aspect is only brought into the TV cut, because there is a scene that they added in where they go to Michael Myers, his old room in the sanatorium, and he's got sister written on the wall. But yeah, you saying that, I think you're right. I don't think they, besides that TV cut in that scene, I don't think that they, because then they elaborate on the whole Laurie Strode thing, but yeah, I think that's in the sequel. So that's interesting.
Unless in the first one, it was kind of tied into the whole evil aspect, and how, you know, because Loomis talks extensively about how evil he is and how he can't be changed. There is no saving him unless the
right.
fate
oh, yes.
is tied into that. But I just, you know, rewatching it, that scene really stood out for me.
I mean, that's so interesting to me because I just, time I really didn't think anything about it, but now, wow.
Yeah, I think it stood out as well, particularly watching Zombies film with it, because Zombies film is so focused on that, you know, familial relationship.
Something to ponder really deeply now about,
yeah.
about a film that, you know, really I just thought, it's pretty simple, but...
Yeah, because this last time I watched the original, I did notice that line, and I was trying to figure out kind of how deep, because that sounds like something, because when I had heard the line, I was like, I'm sure that kind of ties into some kind of deeper thing, and I was trying to figure out what it was, and yeah, the only thing I came up with was the brother and sister thing, but yeah, as you said, I think you guys fleshed out on that more, I think you guys said that makes sense.
Maybe Carpenter even had it in the back of his mind, like, you know, hey, if this comes out as I think it's going to come out, we're going to do a sequel here. So let's talk a little bit about Fate. I mean, you never know. I would love to ask him personally. That would be quite interesting.
Well, I don't think he wanted to do. Wasn't I think he only did the sequel because he was under contract. I don't think he ever really wanted to do it. If I remember hearing that correctly.
Well, they were.
I don't know.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, you know, I don't know the backstory behind that.
I'm not sure if he... I think he wanted to do it because after Halloween 3, which he had nothing to do with, obviously it was just name only, and produced as a kind of marketing ploy, really, I think, with the Halloween name, he was approached by a film production company to write Halloween 4, and he was working on that with Deborah Hill. And that's when the producer, who had been with all the films from the beginning, took them to court and actually won the subsequent legal battle for ownership of the Halloween as a trademark. So he was, you know, there is a script somewhere for his version of Halloween 4, but then that was taken forward by the producer.
I'd love to read that.
Yeah.
Oh, me too. He's like a holy grail item right there.
Right.
I know it's weird, and a lot of people disagree with me on this too, but I love Halloween 2. Actually, I prefer it to Halloween 1.
Oh, I'm right there with you, man. I don't think it's a better film, but I think it's because I'm a big fan of 80s slasher movies, and it's a kind of a dumber film, but I think it's fun. I think it's a really entertaining movie.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely a dumber film, but it's certainly just adrenaline filled, like it just never stops. It
for
never
sure.
relents even for a moment. Whereas the first one is more a slow burn, more thoughtfully paced.
Actually, oh yeah, you like the second one as well. Do you prefer it to the first one?
I kind of see them as one big film because they pick up the second one picks up exactly where the first one lets off. I see it as really, you know, one film kind of segmented into two. And they're quite different paths, but I enjoy them both for what they are. Like you say, the second one I have a lot of fun with. I find it to be quite comical, but action, you know, constantly moving. Whereas the first one got that sense of dread, that eeriness, and that kind of slower pace. So I like them both. There's kind of two halves that really complement each other.
That's a really good way to think of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially since it does pick up right where the other one left off, as you said.
Now
it's another. I should have just marathoned both of them.
Yeah, that'd be a cool back to back. It's a really
yeah.
cool back to back watch. Those.
Yeah, I mean, I've done it before when AMC plays them. I don't know if they did this year, but in the past, you know, I guess we should get to the ratings and let's talk about John Carpenter's Halloween first. I mean, I know we've talked a lot about it, but man, Carpenter's Halloween is certainly a classic, and I feel like if you are a fan of the horror genre, then if you haven't seen Halloween, then I'm surprised you're even listening to this podcast. It's an outstanding film. I would say that some of the stuff maybe doesn't hold up to modern day standards, but that's what delivers some of the charm for me about it too, and just old movies in general, because they're always of their time. So maybe the kills aren't as gory as some horror fans would like, but, you know, and the acting is a bit dated, as I've said, but it's a very charming horror film, which I know charming and horror aren't typically things that you would think go together, but I'm going to give it a solid 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I think the film is a definition of a classy horror film. I think it's done really artfully and with a really great vision from John Carpenter. As you said earlier, he knew what he wanted to do, and he really set out and put that on the screen. And sure, certain things haven't aged well. I called it timeless earlier, but I mean, obviously some things differ with age. But overall, I think a lot of the terror and a lot of the relatability of it is very timeless, and I'll always kind of be able to connect to it in a certain way that other horror films, especially ones today, I won't say never get, but don't tend to as much as that film did. It really, really hits home, kind of in the way the film I talked about last week, The Strangers, kind of did, where it really, I mean, it doesn't feel quite as real as that, but it definitely hits home in a certain way. It's a more realistic slasher than most, and that to me is kind of scary. And actually, you took the words right out of my mouth. I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. It's not a perfect film, but I really, really love this movie a lot.
I agree with everything that you've both said. I think it does have the original film an element of being timeless, just in the way that you relate to it, as opposed to the fact that it's set at a certain time. The music, iconic, everything. As soon as it comes on, it puts a big smile on my face. And like I say, it's one of my favorite horrors. So I would give it, I would say, a 9 out of 10. So the remake, I didn't hate it as much as some others may, but you know what? It's watchable. It does look good. It is always going to have the comparison with the original, and that's nothing to be ashamed of. And I did like the way that it went into the backstory, certain elements of it, but other elements completely took me out of the film. The characters were over the top. The violence was very at odds in terms of realism and being gritty, and it just never, it's a lot of different elements going on there that just never quite seemed to gel, but it was watchable enough, so I'd probably give it 5 out of 10.
I think that pretty much everything you said is correct on it. I mean, it's a well-made film as far as quality. The acting is pretty good. Now, for me, I actually prefer Scout Taylor to Jamie Lee Curtis, which I know is blasphemy for a lot of people. Certainly the gore is over the top, but there are certain scenes that I just really enjoyed about this movie. I thought the examination of Michael Myers as a child was actually really well done. There is a huge disconnect between when he's a child and when he's an adult. I mean, they really feel like two different films. And with that, I can say the uncut version certainly goes on a bit too long. Like, by the end of it, I was just like, all right, it needs to be over already. It's definitely not as good as John Carpenter's Halloween. I will agree with that. But I don't think that it's just a horrible film that a lot of people, I mean, they just think it's awful. And I would say that it's quite watchable. So I am going to give it a 6 out of 10.
As I said before, I just think I see what Zombie was going for here, but to me, he does it in a way that totally just collapses in on itself and does the opposite of what he was trying to do, where he was trying to make it more realistic and grounded and gritty. I think he comes up with something that's so over the top, it's just goofy and silly. And something I didn't mention earlier was where I said that the original Halloween has got a really, I think when shit kind of hits the fan in that, it gets scary. And in this one, in Zombie's version, I think it just gets boring in that third act. When the action comes in, it's just dull, and I really don't care. Like, I was just, like, checking my phone. I was like, man, this has got to, as you said, it just has to wrap up. Maybe I should check out the theatrical cut at some point, but as far as this director's cut I saw, it's just, nothing hits with me. Whenever I watch this movie, I want to like it so badly. I try really, really, really hard to like it. It just never connects with me on almost any level. I probably have to give this a 2 out of 10, really. I really, really don't like this movie. I really hate it. And it's almost like I only don't despise it because its sequel is so shitty. It makes this one not quite as shitty. But it still sucks. I don't like it.
Well, there you go, folks. And we certainly have a verdict and winner by quite a large margin, and that is Carpenter's original Halloween. And with that, I think we're going to close out here, guys. It's been a pleasure, and as always, and just a blast. Like I said, this is a podcast I've been wanting to do for years and years, and I appreciate you guys taking the time to do it, and thank you so much, Becky, for just all these wonderful notes and background information on both films.
No problem. I must point out that I did get a lot of the notes from a book called Retro Scream, which is written by Christopher T. Ketting, and it basically just talks about classic horror films and their remakes, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's got so much information in. I've learned so many different things just by kind of dipping into it here and there, really. So that's a really, really big recommend. I think any kind of fans of horror would be able to pick up some things from it that they didn't know before, so definitely pick that one up.
It goes into some vast detail, and I mean, these are the films we love, so you want to read about them, and, you know, just, I guess it's the next best thing to actually being there, right?
Yep, and I also find the kind of cultural aspects really interesting, looking at the films and when they're remade, any particular themes that have been taken on, new themes, things that have been dropped, potentially, just kind of comparing the two. I find that, like we have done today, but in terms of that, it's just really, really fascinating. Like I say, loads of things that I didn't know, and it does have some bits of scripts and things like that in there, like we were talking about before with Carpenter's script for the fourth potential Halloween film. It has a lot of bits and bobs, like outtakes, things that didn't appear in certain films, so really, really fascinating read.
Very, very cool. So yeah, definitely check that out. Very quickly here, before we end off, just want to mention our website and as well as some of the upcoming shows we have. And we've just got a lot of great topics coming up, and we would love to invite everyone here, you know, all of our listeners to take part in it, to come and join us, to send in your voicemails. And you can do that by sending them to UnitedNationsOfHorror@gmail.com. And we look forward to seeing everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'll see you guys.
Halloween night 1963 in Haddonfield, Illinois, there would be a gruesome case of sibling rivalry between kids in the Myers family, when Michael, a six-year-old, leisurely walked into his sister's room silently and butchered her body so violently he left for a mental facility. And when the state hospital deputy relaxed the maximum security, then Michael would stop waiting patiently for another chance at a murder spree. His doctor, Sam Loomis, tried legally to put him away for eternity. Said, "My patient has no humanity." But others did not exactly agree. They said, "Michael was the epitome of the ideal patient's activity. No crying, no talking, no moving. He would just sit and stare absentmindedly." Yet 15 years later, he wandered free by breaking out from his captivity. Now all he had left to do was to flee back to his old peaceful community, where his house was sold by Strode Realty, whose daughter became inevitably the subject of all his hostility. A true Michael Myers authority, who has the uncanny proclivity to suffer no serious injury, while friends who are in her vicinity without fail become a casualty. They fall victim to his insanity. They're strangled and mangled creatively. They're grabbed and then stabbed hard repeatedly. They're decapitated so easily. You'd think he'd get bored from monotony. He kills each one individually, employing equal opportunity. It's quality versus more quantity. He'd relive a childhood memory to the best of his own ability, but there would not be much difficulty, since he seems to have no mortality or reason or conscience entirely, devoid of any personality. His sense of life and death and good and evil seemed extremely rudimentary.
The boogeyman's responsibility is to maintain the notoriety of death as an impossibility, or fade slowly into obscurity.
But you are a miracle prodigy.
You've given this killer the third degree. You vanquished the evil amazingly. Ignored all your bothersome OCD to check up on his heart accordingly.
So while he is lying there lifelessly, while you are still breathing so heavily,
you sit there and thank God that finally it's over, it's done with, and luckily you planned each potential contingency. You blinded his eyes temporarily. You drove that knife through his chest cavity. You shot him in every extremity. You forced him right off of the balcony. There's no way in hell that he'd possibly get up and walk right off your property.
That stuff only happens on the TV.
So you'll be safe in police custody. They'll quickly make a positive ID of Michael's cold, twisted anatomy. You'll garner the neighborhood sympathy. And after a good deal of therapy, you'll be back in touch with reality and understand why philosophically the apple does not fall far from the tree when creating our own worst enemy.